Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about. Hello from Arizona. My second conversation at the New Deal Leaders Ideas Summit is with an extraordinary person, both in her life experience and commitment to her community. Iowa Representative Dr. Megan Shrivenus. You heard that right. She's a state legislator who's also a medical doctor with a focus on infectious diseases. We talk about how and why she balances these two very different professions. We also talk about her journey as a child of immigrants in a small Iowa town, to Kenya, to Harvard, and back to Iowa to serve a low-income district in Des Moines. She has big policy ideas rooted in her experience on the ground. She's also just really fun to talk to and a leader to watch. Enjoy. Iowa Representative Dr. Megan Shrivenus, welcome to An Honorable Profession.
Thank you so much, Ryan. It's great to be here.
So we've had doctors who are outside of elected office, but I believe in the 200 plus episodes, you're our first doctor who's braved public office. Why don't you tell us about that choice and how you found yourself in the Iowa legislature?
There aren't many of us who've gotten into public office. As one of my friends said when I decided I wanted to run for office, one of my roommates from college, she's like, "Hold on, did you figure out you couldn't be a student anymore and you just don't like to make money?" But it really was a random path I never thought I was going to take. And it ultimately just came down to my patients. I have always really worked in a lower income, more diverse setting, both inner city as well as rural areas. And that's the population I love, people who don't necessarily have the best access to care, and seeing how we can help augment their story and help connect them a little bit more. But a lot of the burdens that they were facing that prevented them from getting access to care are more of the social aspects. The fact that they're not sure if they're going to be able to pay their rent or if they can feed their kids or how they're even going to get to their appointments. And when those daily things are in question because we have systems in place that prevent people from succeeding and living healthy lives, then it doesn't really matter what I do in my clinic office. And it's so important. I mean, doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs, anybody who's a clinician, you're so important to an individual story. But I just felt like there was more I could do if I could change the system in which we lived. And that's why I ran.
And so now you are about 1 year in?
Yeah, about year and a half.
Almost. Year and a half in. How have you found it?
It sounds masochistic, but I love it.
Really? Okay.
I really do. It's nice also because I see patients about half the point of the year when we're not in session. I do some outpatient throughout the entire year, but my inpatient time is during the half the year we're not in session, and that's when I really get to dig into people's stories and hear what brings them to the hospital and how I can help them. And every time I'm in that inpatient setting, that means I'm in the hospital, I'll do it for weeks at a time, I always leave so excited because of the human connection I'm able to make, but also with new ideas. Thoughts as to, if only this was in place, I could have helped her better. And so it really inspires me to then want to be back in the legislature when session comes into play so I can actually try to make those changes happen.
And so tell me about trying to bring those changes into the legislative context. There's not a lot of people who will have either your personal experience or your professional expertise. So how do you try to translate what you hear and what you know into legislation?
It's all about stories. I'm a very big believer in stories. And it's not about highlighting myself. It's about highlighting each person's story and how we can impact that. So I'm fortunate. I always keep everybody's privacy, of course, in place. But I'm fortunate that I have patients who enable me to share their stories so that way other legislators can understand how the policies they're passing are actually impacting everyday life. It could be somebody in their own community, somebody that they might know. And they start to think, oh, hold on. You're saying this happened in our backyard. Who else is facing this issue? And they start to look at some of these policies from a different lens. One of the things that we were recently talking about, and I'm very hopeful that we'll get across the finish line, is to improve the prior authorization process. So prior authorizations are these hurdles that you have to pass whenever an insurance company, including Medicaid and Medicare, are involved. It means even though all the guidelines say, the symptoms you have, I need to get an MRI on you, and that any clinician would actually say it's malpractice if I don't order one, I still need to get insurance approval. Now, the problem is this approval can take so long. So especially in emergent situations, when I'm in the inpatient setting and there's somebody who is direly sick, you're in the ICU, I don't have that much time to figure out what's going on and treat you before you have permanent ramifications, if not death. And we've actually seen horrible statistics and data on how prior authorizations delay care and do cause these bad outcomes. But it was telling stories of patients I saw, patients that trusted me, that changed so many people's minds in the legislature because they don't have the same exposures I do. And many of them have then started to think, hold on, has this impacted somebody I love? And because of that, we were able to put together a bipartisan bill this year that, knock on wood, makes it to the governor's desk. And so I'm very hopeful.
That's amazing. I mean, having worked in government and healthcare specifically, it's all so frustrating because it always feels like the system just doesn't make sense from a system perspective, from a health perspective. It's just, it's struggle. And like those things that are life and death can be so critical. I guess one of the things I'm interested in is where your appreciation of storytelling came from. In my experience, one of the hardest constituencies and interest groups to work with was doctors when they came to my office, because it's like, well, the data says this, or common sense says this, and like, I'm a doctor, so you need to just do this. And it was always like, well, let me explain why it's so hard. And they were frustrated. I was frustrated. And so storytelling is patience, and it's trying to connect with people on a human level. And so where did that skill set come from? Have you always had it? Have you developed it?
As my mother will tell you, I could find a lamppost and talk to it for an hour. I just love to learn about people around me. I never thought I was going to be in medicine, actually, until later in life. I had initially thought that I might go into law because I loved reading. I loved literature. I loved putting it together with policy and highlighting things in different ways. But it was an experience I had when I was in high school, where I ended up in rural Kenya on a random internship. And being in this area that at the time actually had one of the highest rates of HIV in the world, with 6 out of every 10 reproductive age adults being positive, according to the UN. It was nicknamed the malaria sphere. And they had so many challenges when it just came to household food security. But yet they were some of the happiest people, some of the most welcoming people. And it just really opened my eyes to wanting to learn about everybody around me. And it was listening to them, seeing what they did every day, and seeing how, despite having relatively what we would consider so little here in the U.S., they were still so much more generous than of spirit of anything that they did get. It just motivated me to always want to be somebody who could listen and be there to see how I can help augment somebody's life.
Can you tell us your story? I mean, I've been reading about you, and yeah, daughter of immigrants, grew up in small town Iowa, apparently was in Kenya during high school, Peru, doing infectious disease research. Like, give us the short version of sort of how you found yourself where you are today.
Honestly, I attribute a lot of it to my parents and my brother. I had an older brother who was 6 years ahead of me in school. And I remember when I was very little, one of my earliest memories was him volunteering. And my parents were always of the notion that you should always give back to your community and volunteer. And so they really got me involved in just trying to get into every aspect of the community and figure out how in small town Iowa, we could each help our neighbors get a little bit better, or maybe have a little bit happier of a life. And they would be there for us when we needed them and vice versa. And so I think it was really that spirit that probably made me more in tune to become a doctor. And I ended up, like I mentioned, going to Kenya in the middle of high school. And it was an organization called the World Food Prize. It's basically like a Nobel Peace Prize, but for people who are doing work in hunger and food insecurity issues. It was started by Norman Borlaug. He received the Nobel Peace Prize himself because he is attributed with having saved the most lives of anybody in the world because he was the father of the Green Revolution.
Wow.
And they didn't have a hunger prize, so they gave him the Peace Prize. And so he wanted to start bringing this consortium of minds together to really elevate this problem and how we can solve it together. And when he started doing this, he also decided he wanted to invest in students early on. So he started to bring in high school students to learn from these brilliant minds who would listen to our thoughts and our ideas. Completely insane to think about now. And from that moment, I realized what I wanted to do was really be at that crux where I could help people who are on the ground while enabling them to utilize their life to change the system so they could better function. And that's what I started to do. I always thought I was going to do it from a research perspective. And that's when I first got inspired to want to be a doctor, specifically infectious disease because of the things I had seen. And I ended up just doing a lot of global health work and ended up in residency, continued to do global health work. I mean, I was in a different country every summer doing all these different types of projects. But the one thing that ubiquitously stuck out was we have all of the same problems in these rural areas around the globe that also exist in rural Iowa or rural Nebraska. But nobody puts the same solutions in place because they don't think of those places as relating. And that's something that I wanted to help change that framework. I wanted to be a part of the global health world, but also a part of helping bring those same solutions that were working there to my own hometown. And so that's where I started to work in rural health equity specifically. And it was through that adventure that I started to do more advocacy. And it was through my advocacy that I realized some of these people don't even have the right values. Some of the people who are holding office, who are passing these policies, when I would try to convince them why they needed to do something, something that could save people's lives, they sometimes didn't care. There are some really good politicians out there, don't get me wrong. But to see so many people who didn't care being able to push that yes or no button made me say, why don't I do it myself?
I think one of my questions is, you know, there's such a deep divide in the country, cultural, political, economic, between rural and urban. And now you serve and represent an underserved urban population. You have this professional focus on a rural population. How do you bridge that divide, think about that divide? Because you're right. It's like there, in some ways, rural populations have more in common, perhaps, with rural populations in other countries than they would with a more urban population. Mm-hmm. But then there are commonalities.
Mm-hmm. There's so much interconnectedness. And if you just look at the diversity of the populations, a lot of the rural areas, especially in Iowa, actually are a lot more diverse than people think because we have farm workers. We have a lot of immigrants that are contributing to our communities. They think of that as purely an inner city issue. And so one of the things we tried to do during the pandemic, I partnered with some of my colleagues, one who's actually based here at ASU, to create videos that were culturally relevant to populations that people don't think are typically in Iowa, both in urban and rural. And we'd use those videos and create them in a way that wasn't using a baseball analogy or an American football analogy, but instead for some of my Spanish-speaking populations, we would talk about the grandmother being the matriarch and why she thinks the vaccine's important. Or we would talk about being in the field and the exposures you have and answer some of the questions that were more relevant to their life. And a lot of that played over actually between the urban and the rural areas because it was finally something that was culturally relevant, even if they are in different settings. But then you see some of these other issues also bridging those gaps. Mental health. We don't have enough. We're 51st in the nation, behind even DC, and per capita resources for mental health in our state. That touches rural and urban. And if you can't find it in urban areas, nobody in rural areas is going to find it either. Same with opiates. We have a huge issue there. Healthcare access. There's so many things that we can work on that would improve lives for both populations.
I'm curious, you have such deep expertise in health policy, but as a state legislator, you get to now worry about refuse policy and trash and roads policy and all these other things. How does your training and mindset inform or maybe not inform when you're trying to deal with the thousands of other issues that you have to deal with?
So I have been fortunate to have a very windy background. I worked for the USDA for a while, so I have a lot of ag experience. My parents are vets, and I grew up giving vaccines to pigs.
Okay.
And then I also was on the State Board of Education when I was younger. So I have a really random background that I'm able to draw a little bit from. But more than anything, it's because healthcare isn't everything we do. You gave an example of trash policy.
Right.
Having proper sanitation is one of the most basic and important principles that the WHO, the World Health Organization, implements anytime we have a national disaster, anytime we have a time of war or conflict or any type of health emergency. Because in a humanitarian crisis, if you can't get sanitation correct, you're going to have widespread disease everywhere. And if you look at things like housing, housing is healthcare. If you can't get appropriate housing, you're not going to lead a healthy life. That is so integral to one's overall healthcare. So all of these things really do come back to one's health. And people often call it the social determinants of health because it really is a multifactorial aspect that relates to how a person can succeed in life.
And I think the social determinants of health, sort of informed health policy, makes tons of sense. There are efforts in some of the areas that you really focus on to just ignore or roll back that area of reproductive rights, right? How do you navigate when you have people who just profoundly disagree with the policies that you're trying to implement? And in some cases, as we sit in Arizona, are winning in terms of changing the health landscape for especially underserved populations.
So a lot of it comes down to framing. You can often find middle ground on certain things that will enable you to get to a good compromise. And then there are certain things that you just can't do that on. But Iowa was the center of attention last year because of our 6-week abortion ban. We had a special session in the summer. Arizona now stole our thunder, but that's thunder I'm willing to let them steal.
Yeah.
But I try to view these policies from a more objective standpoint of trying to understand where my colleagues on the other side of the aisle might be coming from. And so with the 6-week abortion ban, I knew many of them. Religiously, we were just never going to agree on a religious argument. We're never going to agree on whether this is right or wrong. But many of them have heard this rhetoric about what they believe abortion is used for. So I stood on the floor and instead told them the story of a patient of mine who had cancer and a pregnancy she badly wanted, but had to have an abortion because it's the only way she could get treatment. And there was no way she was going to survive to delivery. So neither the fetus or the mother was going to survive. And it reframes it in a way that makes people think, okay, this isn't necessarily about the religious argument. Or I try to find areas that we agree on. So in our 6-week abortion ban, the statutes surrounding rape and incest, the exceptions really weren't exceptions. You have to have notified a medical provider within 45 days of rape in order to qualify for an abortion. 45 days, a lot of people don't even know they're pregnant at that point. Many people might have divulged to a friend or somebody that they trust, but how many people go see a medical provider after rape? We believe it's less than half, maybe even 1 in 3 is what we estimate. So to put these restrictions in place, if you truly believe survivors of sexual assault should be able to get the care they need, which many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle do, then this bill is not the way. And so I went at it from trying to adjust it from those perspectives. We luckily were able to get an injunction in the court within a few days of this bill passing. So abortion is still available in Iowa. And we just had oral arguments, actually, this past Thursday in front of our Supreme Court, where this law is being challenged right now. And our Supreme Court is completely Republican right now. But many of them also agree with the duress that these limitations are placing, the undue burden, which is a standard we have in our Constitution. So really trying to go at it from understanding the policy and how it might apply even with their personal values is a way that I can find commonalities.
Let's talk about Iowa. It was a blue state that voted for Barack Obama. Felt like it moved solidly to a red state. Is it moving back to a purple state? What's the situation on the ground?
We've always been a purple state. Okay. We went for Obama twice, but we still were a purple state then. We've now gone for Trump, still a purple state. If you look even at the same time that we went for Trump, and then the following midterm election, 2018, we have 4 congressional seats in Iowa. 3 of those seats went blue. In 2020, we retained at least one of those seats. And the seats that we lost were by such small margins that if we had just increased turnout a little bit, and this was a year in which we weren't doing grassroots because of COVID, so people weren't door knocking. So despite that challenge, it was still such small margins, even though our opponents were. It shows over and over again that we're all just within reach. It just takes a little bit more grassroots advocacy. It takes some fundraising, and it takes people understanding that they need to invest in Iowa, because when we let go of middle America, when we let go of rural America and focus only on urban centers, the messaging for the Democratic Party will never be in line with what most Americans need. It won't be in line with our national consensus. And we need to embrace the diversity of our geographic locations and ensure that our messaging reflects that as well.
And what kind of messaging do you think resonates both in your district, which again, mm-hmm. more urban, underserved, or the community you grew up in, mm-hmm. more rural? What could the party do better mm-hmm. to connect?
So education. Education is a huge issue for everybody. 92% of Iowans go to public schools, but yet we passed an overwhelmingly biased school voucher bill that is going to undermine the success of public schools, especially in rural areas. And so that's something that we need to really play up. This year, we unfortunately also passed a bill that's going to further undermine special ed and mental health services in rural areas by defunding these things that we call the area education agencies that have been around for 5 decades that I received 2,000 emails on, including many from Republicans, and not a single one was in favor. And I'm talking about rural Republicans and urban Republicans. But yet we passed it because we had a governor who wanted to push it through, and it only passed by one vote. They know they're taking bad votes, and they know they're doing bad policy. The question is, are we going to be able to put this out there in a place where their constituents understand what happened and that they need to hold their legislators accountable? That's what we need to work on as a party. We need to tailor our messaging. What works in Des Moines isn't going to work in Garner or Cedar Rapids too, actually, even though it's a bigger city, but it's not going to work in Fort Dodge. It's not going to work in Council Bluffs. You have to specifically tailor messaging to the local communities and utilizing our local party structure, which we've overlooked for so long, is a way that we can do that.
And so when you're looking at 2024, mm-hmm. is there a potential that your state goes for Biden, elects statewide Democrats?
I don't believe we'll go for Biden in Iowa. But we have so few electoral votes, he's not going to be spending time or money there. So that's a part of it. And he didn't last time around. And I don't fault him. There are more important states for him to try to get electoral votes from. And that's what he should be doing. But building from ground up, we can truly make huge marginal gains in our local offices. Many places in Iowa, the city council and the county supervisors have majority blue seats. But those seats are then represented in the state legislature by a red senator or representative. Why is that? It's because we aren't focusing on putting money or messaging out in those areas, especially messaging that works. One example is wanting to run the exact same talking points about reproductive health in Des Moines as I would in my hometown of Fort Dodge. People in Fort Dodge understand the story when we frame it about healthcare, when we don't frame it as purely just abortion should go to everybody. When we talk about it being impacting somebody's access to cancer care, when we talk about it impacting somebody's ability to lead a successful life, that same messaging, people want more progressive messaging in an urban center like Des Moines. And when we try to apply that messaging out to Fort Dodge, people recoil. They get the sense that we're trying to say abortion's for everybody. And don't get me wrong, I think everybody should have the right to make their own decisions. It's only between them and what they talk about in their office with their clinicians. That said, we can talk about the stories that relate to more people, that undermine the rhetoric, the false rhetoric that so many on the opposite side of the aisle are regurgitating.
Tell me about that first campaign you ran mm-hmm. in 2018, ran again in 2022. Mm-hmm. How, in all the medical training you've had, they don't teach you necessarily door knocking and fundraising and all that, all the things you have to do. Like, tell me what it was like. And, you know, maybe some aspiring doctors, nurses, other medical professionals are maybe listening and like, wait, I should run for office and will it translate? Will I be appreciated?
Yes, you should. Everyone who's in healthcare should consider it because you already have a skill set that's built in. You are taught to listen to your patients, not just to the obvious of what they're saying, but to observe them, their body language, and to actually make them feel comfortable and that they can trust you, because that's the most important thing you can get as a healthcare practitioner. Because only then can you actually diagnose and successfully treat somebody. That directly correlates to being on the doors. I would go to the door and I would just say, hey, tell me what concerns you. What's going on in your life? I would have the most fun conversation. Sometimes I'd end up on a patio with somebody for an hour as he told me about his old days of collecting tractors and all the antiques that he has in his garage. Nothing to do with the policy. But the fact that I'm there and willing to listen, I got his vote even though he had never voted for a Democrat in his life. And that's what healthcare practitioners can do. We're not politicians. We're people who heal, and we want to heal the systems in which our people live. Do it. Please do it.
Do you get a lot of people who are like, you know, we really need to get a stoplight here, and my shoulder's been acting up. I need you to take a look while you're there.
Actually, oftentimes, the first thing that happens when I knock on a door, especially because a lot of people might know me in the community since I might have taken care of them or their family members, they'll open the door and they'll be like, Dr. Megan, oh, I have a rash. Can you take a quick look at this? So everybody said, oh, you must get hard questions at the door. I'm like, no, I just have to do some research usually. Match up some pictures. But no, it's great though, because there's that foundation there of trust already. If they're willing to show me a rash, right? I love it in the house. A week doesn't go by that I don't have to examine a colleague. And I'm not talking about just people in my own caucus. I'm talking about people from across the aisle, or even sometimes in the Senate chamber, actually, who will text me up and say, can you come over here and look at something for me? And we'll be sitting in committee and I'll be looking down somebody's throat. But having that type of comfort with people and building that type of relationship has enabled me to then create bipartisan policy that actually has been successful.
Amazing. Yeah. I'll take a look at that. I got a bill. Well, while I examine you, why don't you read
it? Let me tell you about my mental health ideas.
Well, you have the little tongue depressor in their mouth so they can't respond. Exactly. They have to listen.
Exactly.
I know, because when I was telling people I was going to be talking to you today, the first question everybody had was, how does she do it? Like, how does she find the time, the energy, everything else? So time management secrets, or do you just not sleep, or insane amounts of caffeine? Like, how does it work?
I actually don't drink caffeine really, besides tea every now and then.
Okay.
People are very shocked by that. I used to do 30-hour calls and I would drink water, and all of my nurses would look at me and say,
wow.
But I just have never – you don't want to see me on caffeine. When we go on a road trip, we'll do – sometimes my partner, he'll give me like a little bit of soda because he wants me to stay awake to keep him awake if we're on a long road trip. But then I'm just bouncing in the seat dancing to music. So no, honestly, it's having a ton of Google calendars. When my legislative clerk came on this year, she looked at my calendars and she's like, oh, wow. But it's just really about being – very close attention to detail, making sure that I track everything in the sense of where I need to be when. And the energy honestly just comes from people. I'm very extroverted in the sense that I feed off of getting to know other people. And especially if we can collaborate, think about what we can do to make our community better, that just excites me so much. And that happens in the medical setting when I get to see patients. And then it happens in session when I'm talking to people from all different walks of life who might have an expertise on how I can turn something into policy that I wouldn't have known how to do on my own. And so it's really just trying to, I don't even know how to say, I guess it's just really just finding joy in what I'm doing every day that drives me and continues to drive me. And then I'm very fortunate to have a supportive family, a very supportive family. My mother is it's hilarious. One of my friends was always telling me, your mom has a busier schedule than you in her job, but yet on her vacation, she becomes your personal assistant.
That always helps. Yes. Mom, yes. Keeping you going is really key.
She's my travel agent always.
Long-term policy goals. Hopefully we get the pre-authorization bill across the line. In 5-10 years, what is a successful healthcare policy in Iowa look like?
One of the most important things that we are suffering ubiquitously throughout our state is mental health. We have a dearth of services, a complete dearth. We don't have the capacity as far as nursing to even have the beds that we currently have in the state staffed. But even if all of those were staffed 100%, we'd still have one of the lowest per capita bed availability. When we have a skyrocketing population when it comes to depression, anxiety, and even suicidal ideation. So we really need to build an infrastructure in our state that invests into ensuring that we have spaces both for long-term care, urgent care, immediate access, critical access care, and then also ensuring that we're able to bridge those people into long-term outpatient care. And we need to do it within local communities. Sometimes now, if you are lucky to get a bed, if you're in the middle of a mental health crisis, you might be 5-6 hours away from home. We're utilizing our police forces, we're utilizing our EMS to transport people when they also are in shortage in their own communities. So it's funding, it's safety, it's access to health that are once again all being impacted when we take those people away from their posts. So really, we have a large surplus in our budget in Iowa. It's projected to be $2.1 billion come June 30th this year. And we're not using it. We're increasing it every year. People in Iowa are suffering, but we're not investing in them. So we need to take that money and actually put it into creating the sustainable infrastructure. We can use our opiate settlement funds to help create a sustainable infrastructure for abuse and addiction services as well, which goes hand in hand with so much of this mental health crisis. And then we need to start looking at how we're connecting to people where they are, helping to increase preventive care instead of always relying on giving care in the moment. And then we need to go back and look at our education system. For the last 15 years, we have not even met the rate of inflation in increasing our education budget every year. So we are really defunding our schools every single year. Iowa was the pinnacle of public education for decades under both party rule. In the last 15 years, we slipped from number one in the country, which we had held for decades, to some measures have us even at 48. And that's all because we're not willing to invest in our schools, our students, our teachers, our support staff. We're not willing to give them wages that enable them to live by just working one job. And we're making them use those meager wages they do get to buy supplies for many of their students because they care about them. They're acting as teacher, they're acting as babysitter, they're acting as social worker and mental health counselor. We need to fix all of these by just investing in our school systems and preventing the further closure of more of these systems, which is happening every single year in Iowa. And we need to actually work on retaining the teachers that we produce at UNI, which is one of the really great teacher colleges in this country. But so many of them are choosing to go to neighboring states after they graduate because of the respect and the work that they'll get to do there compared to what's happening in Iowa. And these are all things we can easily fix if we just partner with our local school districts and actually invest into our systems instead of just racking up our money to save for a rainy day. That rainy day is today.
My final question, you have enormous talent, obvious from our conversation.
I paid you to say that.
Yeah, exactly. How and where you spend that talent will be a big question. And is it continuing to practice medicine and serve in the legislature? Is it running a nonprofit? Is it working in an executive position in state government? How do you think about how you can have the most impact?
I think about where the change is needed most based on, honestly, the everyday conversations I have in my community, as well as the time I spend with my patients. And I think about the problems I see and how best I can help be a solution to those problems. And so right now for me, I decided to run for re-election for the legislature because the work is far from being over. I still feel like I'm having an impact. I'm bringing to the table an expertise that hadn't been there before I was elected. There was no physician in the legislature. And so I'm able to challenge some of the deleterious laws in a way that people without that knowledge couldn't. And I'm able to bring forth collaborations that have a deeper understanding of how healthcare works. And then I can do it in a way that also impacts the other factors around healthcare too, the other social determinants. And so while I can still do that and help my patients, I would love to continue to do this combination of being able to get my cup refilled every summer and then going back to the legislature to solve the problems I see.
Amazing. We're so lucky to have you on the podcast. We're lucky to have you in New Deal. Can't wait to see some of these healthcare policies get enacted in Iowa, and then the rest of us who aren't doctors can replicate them in our own states and pretend like we know what we're doing, which is the New Deal secret.
You definitely do. You know a lot more than you think.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service, and because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.